Larry Hannon, you've been covering this since the start.
Yes.
Two jurors now have gone public. You watch those jurors every day in the courtroom. What are your thoughts this morning?
Well, as interesting as what they've had to say are, what I really want to hear is the three jurors who wanted to acquit. Both of the jurors who've come forward favored convicting him. And we haven't really heard the explanation from those three jurors as to why they think he was not guilty of murdering Jordan Davis. And that's the mystery to me now, because it was 9-3. Most people expected him to be convicted of at least second degree murder. So a lot of people felt first degree murder was a stretch, but most people expected him to be convicted of something. And based on what these two jurors have said, they deadlocked on second degree murder or manslaughter as well.
Right, not just the top charge. Fred Matthews, juror number 8, an African-American woman, speaking to the media today, is saying that they did not consider the racial aspects of this case when they went into their deliberations.
That's what she says. In fact, from the interview I saw, she even goes so far as to say that Michael Dunn was a nice guy, and which is, I'm sure, leaving a lot of folks incredulous. Look, this is part of the jury-picking process for the next trial, should State Attorney Corey do it along with the agreement, I understand, of Jordan Davis's family. This is all part of that process. It's all interesting to watch this, but it really means absolutely nothing at this phase because it's not going to change anything.
Yeah.
But it is good to see what they were thinking. And what they were thinking is basically that the prosecutor did not prove without a shadow of a doubt, the first-degree murder charge. I mean, that's what it proves here, is that the first-degree murder charge and the jury instructions were weak enough that gave those who were doubting an out.
And John Burr, Jeff Billman, Angela Corey, the state attorney, did an interview this week with CNN where she indicated she believes the state's laws on self-defense might need a fresh look in the wake of this verdict.
Well, I mean, I think the state's laws are written in such a way that it gives sort of the benefit to the shooter as opposed to the dead person. I mean, the burden of proof is on, well, I thought maybe I was in danger, so I kind of shot this kid. And, you know, when there is no material danger in any, you know, sort of provable way, I think that's kind of, that's one of the issues. I think that sort of gives license to people who might have a short temper and a ready handgun.
Well, and the state's laws do need tweaking, obviously, but, you know, that wasn't really the problem here. The problem, as I see it, was Dunn was overcharged. The state didn't prove the first-degree case, as Fred said, and the jury was confused.
Do you agree with that, Larry? Critics have said that they feel the state's attorney's office overcharged this case.
Well, let's face it, the state attorney this is not a new criticism of our state attorney. The George Zimmerman trial, the Christian Fernandez trial, you know, the idea that this state attorney overcharges has become a fairly common criticism, Marissa Alexander as well. So, Corey has already said that she's going to retry him, and she's going to retry him for first-degree murder. So, whether we think he's being overcharged or not, they're going forward with first-degree murder, and I don't see Corey changing her mind on that.
And lots of calls as we discuss what came out of the Michael Dunn jury room this week on our First Coast Connect Friday Media Roundtable. 549-2937 to join us. Gil on the South Side is holding. Hello, Gil. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Melissa. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think in terms of the Michael Dunn as well as the Zimmerman trial, the Stand Your Ground law is really responsible for the reason that people are not able to come to a really good decision. Yeah, threatening is too vague. It's way too vague. And there was nothing wrong with our self-defense laws in the first place. I mean, my God, even if you happen to be in the car and somebody's threatening you and you can't get out, the way Michael Dunn says he was, it doesn't give people any reason for them to just kill people on the spot. It's the Stand Your Ground law came as a result of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Committee, and the NRA. They signed it into law under Bush, and the NRA person was standing right there when the law was signed. So what I'm saying is it's great for the NRA. It's bad for people. It's being used very haphazardly. When blacks seem to be involved in Stand Your Ground, they get the 1020 life law. And when whites are involved in the Stand Your Ground law, they get off.
All right, and that's Gil. That's Gil on the South Side. Thanks for the call, Jeff.
I think he's right about something, and that is, and you can't necessarily extricate this sort of gun culture and these and pro gun rights, you know, sort of fanaticism from racial issues. I mean, there's empirical data that do link, you know, racial animus to attitudes, you know, in support of Stand Your Ground and gun ownership, quite frankly. That's not to say that everybody who owns a gun is you know, a member of the Klan or anything like that, but there is a pretty healthy correlation. And I think you have to have, you know, I don't think we do ourselves any favors by not recognizing that fact, by trying to ignore it.
But we get the government that we vote for.
Yes, we do.
Florida has voted in now for the last decade Republicans in charge of the legislature, conservative governors, mm-hmm. Conservative legislators. We have a Republican-oriented sheriff. He's dancing around Standing Your Ground law today once again. I mean, he's the law enforcement officer, but he doesn't want to – he wants to tweak a law that puts guns in the hands of civilians who his officers have to go straighten out. That's what we are. Instead of having a straight line deal here, we get the government we vote for. And as long as we keep the legislature in place that we have, that's conservative oriented and in favor of NRA legislation, this is what we're going to have.
Well, Fred, and you know, critics would say that the districts around the state have been gerrymandered and that they're not quite representative of the Florida population as a whole.
Who's in charge of drawing the districts? The Republicans are the majority. They get to draw the districts, and then you have to take them to court to straighten it out.
And if you look at polling of Republicans, Stand Your Ground is incredibly popular. I mean, mm-hmm. Republicans are doing what their base wants.
Yep.
The head of the Criminal Justice Committee in the House has told me he will not change one comma of Stand Your Ground. He thinks it's working great. He happens to represent a very conservative district. And, you know, we are very polarized on this issue right now, and until there's more of a, you know, until moderates get
Let's
their voice
go to Doran and Doran in Jacksonville. Doran, good morning.
Good morning. Melissa, I've been listening to your coverage and following the case, and my concern as a middle-aged African-American man is something a little bit broader. I understand the racial issues. I've actually been the victim of racial profiling. I also understand the issues of Stand Your Ground. But really, what strikes me about this case and several others is how middle-aged men are acting like teenagers. And where do we end up as a society when middle-aged guys don't have any more restraint than a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old? I think we're really in trouble there. Beyond that, I want to ask the panel, what do you guys think we can do to change the perception of African-American men? Because a lot of this case has to do with the fear that's associated with being a black man. And when some people see a black man or a group of black men, they immediately feel under assault or threatened. And I think we've got to change that perception if we want to get anywhere with these cases.
Thank you for the call, Doran.
I spoke to a woman yesterday who has an 11-year-old son. She's a black woman, and she's very scared about her son heading into his teenage years. She knows he's going to be a big kid as he becomes a teenager. And she said, I'm not sure I want to live in Jacksonville anymore because I'm very afraid that my son could just go to the gas station and end up getting shot for something that wasn't his fault. I mean, we've now had two high-profile trials where black teenagers were shot and killed in the last year. And both of their killers ended up not being convicted of the crimes. And it's a big concern in the African-American community.
Yeah, and what Doran, the question he asked is very complicated because what you're talking about is a middle-aged white guy who heard the music that he immediately termed thug music, saw four young black guys in a car, and it took a microsecond for him to come to a conclusion that they were a threat. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those societal triggers are very deep, and it's a really tough problem.
But, I mean, part of it is that, you know, we segregate ourselves as a society. So, you know, if you're an older age, you know, middle-aged white man, you probably don't have a lot of interaction with middle-aged black people or young black people or you know, young Hispanics, things like that. And the more you do, the more you segregate yourself as a society, the less understanding there is of you know, that mm-hmm. these kids are listening to what was the guy's little whatever his name is
Little Reese.
Sorry, I'm showing my age. but you know, you have that, and you know, I've listened to that song that came up, and you know, it's not my thing, but whatever. But you know, is that automatically assume that's the worst when you know I can listen to Johnny Cash talk about taking a shot of cocaine and shooting my woman down, and nobody really thinks I'm going to do that to you.
It was telling in the letter that Michael Dunn wrote that was published when he gave his account of the events. He said that he and his girlfriend left because they wanted to get back around their own kind of people. Very telling.
And he said when he testified that he was afraid they'd come back with more of their gangster friends, which sort of shows his mindset.
Yeah. Addie in Atlantic Beach. Addie, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say that I just moved down the Jacksonville area from New York City, and I am regretting my decision a bit because I have a young daughter, and I now have to figure out if I'm going to teach her how to survive in a society where she might be deemed a threat as an African-American woman. I didn't have to think about that when I lived up north, and I think that that's a big problem that is seems to come up a lot down south. And certainly it seems to be in Florida with the Stand Your Ground law, where just by being black, you're considered a threat to someone. And I think it's a sad way our society has become that just by existing and trying to live your life, that you're somehow viewed as a threat. And even when you think there will be some justice in the trial and in the law, it still doesn't happen, and the accusers are then turned around and viewed themselves as some sort of victim because they had to endure some sort of injustice by shooting someone and they don't have any sympathy, they don't have any understanding of how they were wrong. They just see themselves as victims and not how this is a larger view of how society views black youth.
Addie, thanks. And sorry to hear you have those regrets. I appreciate the call, Addie. Lots of people waiting on hold to talk about the trial, but we do have to move on and talk about the other news of the week. Now, also making headlines, Mayor Alvin Brown is being accused of strong-arm tactics as he works on pension reform for the city of Jacksonville. This week, JEA board member Peter Bauer told the Times Union that the Brown administration pressured him to vote yes on the mayor's proposal to dip into JEA's coffers to help solve the city's pension problems. However, the mayor's office is pushing back, with spokesman David DeCamp telling WJCT the city is committed to partnering with JEA on this. It's 549-2937 to join us as we discuss the politics of this. Local GOP officials, one official used a racially coded word, accusing the mayor's office of thuggish tactics in this debate. Fred Matthews, that's the term thug has become quite a political hot potato as of late.
The 2015 campaign is on. If you don't think it's on, then you are just living in a fairyland. Look, I just, you know, in conversations I've had with members of the administration on this issue and on where they're going forward, I just don't quite see if the mayor's office understand how deep this party line divide is for them, and how just using that as just as an example. I mean, I was puzzled as to why the mayor made this proposal about the JEA when his task force is already trying to slog it through this thing. He gives them one more thing to do publicly that they either expected or didn't expect, and they didn't do the work at the JEA ahead of time to make sure that this sort of thing would happen to him. I mean, and now he's being beat on both sides of this thing. He's going to impose an agreement on the JEA when he doesn't even have an agreement yet on pension reform.
Well, let me just discuss what the talking points they sent over, and you guys can react. They point out that JEA is a community-owned, taxpayer-owned asset, okay? And that it's appropriate to have this discussion with the utility in this regard. What about that?
Well, sure, you can have the discussion, but to claim a partnership and then announce this what the partnership is going to do when the other side of the partnership has no agreement with you is pretty bad tactics.
And the mayor has a history of kind of announcing things without giving fair warning to the people who will be affected by it. I mean, we've heard this complaint from city council a lot that the mayor doesn't talk to them. He makes these proposals, and the first time they hear about it is when they read about it in the newspaper or see it on TV.
So you could make the argument that perhaps work is needed on the inside game, but I think that the poll, even though the mayor's office has reacted to this new UNF poll that shows he's gone from 70% approval to 60% approval, I think most politicians would still love to have a 60% approval rating. On the outside game, getting out in the community and telling the taxpayers what they, you know, the type of message that they want to hear, which is, hey, I'm not raising taxes or fees, that plays well with the taxpayers.
Well, and that's, I think that was the thing that struck me the most about his JA proposal. I mean, Fred makes a good point. He did this about a week before his own task force was supposed to announce its big thing. And he comes out and says, wait, I got it. And his proposal is, you know, the mayor, being a smart man who can do math, recognizes that you don't do this without revenue. But he doesn't want to raise taxes because he's got to run for re-election. So, you know, so it's now up to the JA to magically conjure $40 million in a year.
Which they clearly don't seem to be amenable to doing.
They're not amenable to doing it. Uh-huh. I mean, the mayor, from the mayor's staff point, they contend that they've gone over the JEA's numbers. And from their accountant standpoint, the JEA can well do it without a negligible impact on taxpayers. The JEA, on the other hand, without going through their numbers yet, says, no, it's going to affect our ratepayers if you do this. So we've already got the argument going.
And let's face it, that picking a fight with JEA is probably pretty politically smart. JEA is not the most popular agency in town. And if the public has to decide between Mayor Brown and JEA, the mayor is probably going to win, at least with public perception.
Well, you know, I understand what you all are saying, but at some point, I think the set of facts are going to seep into the public perception that hey, there's no beef here. These proposals that are coming out of the mayor's office are kind of hollow. I mean, there's a pattern going on here.
Let's go to George and Ortega.
I think people will realize that.
George and Ortega is on the line. George, good morning.
Yes, thanks for taking the call. I really find it kind of disingenuous and inappropriate for the mayor's office to allege racially cooked words in this debate. And it just shows to me that really don't think that they've been able to push their agenda and that, quite frankly, they're not very good at their job.
George, thanks for the call. Meanwhile, David DeCamp just emailed the show moments ago pointing out or clarifying, saying the mayor did not announce the JEA proposal ahead of the task force. We presented it to the task force for review. The task force supported discussions further with JEA.
Okay, so who is going to lead the discussions with the JEA, although those discussions we understand are ongoing? And how is that discussion going to dovetail with the commission's recommendation to the mayor and the council in time for the council to consider it? And is the council going to accept the fact that the JEA is saying we can't afford to do it?
No. Well, are we being tested?
You know, as you said, Fred, the election is on, and not just the mayor's election. Duval County Sheriff John Rutherford said this week he believes Florida does need to look at changing its controversial Stand Your Ground law. We were discussing that a few moments ago with the Michael Dunn case. Now, this comes as the term-limited Rutherford continues to field speculation that he himself might run for mayor against incumbent Alvin Brown. And with more than a year to the local elections, six candidates have already stepped forward to run for the office that will be vacant, the sheriff's office. Lots of jockeying going on right now as people are weighing their odds, trying to see if they're a viable candidate. And it's a game of wait and see. And a lot of behind-the-scenes discussion about these elections, Larry, even though they're more than a year away.
Yeah, and there's so many different pieces that have to move. Obviously, if Rutherford becomes a candidate for mayor, that probably impacts the sheriff's race because we're going to have the mayor's race could become a referendum on Rutherford, which means the person running with Rutherford support for sheriff may not be in as good a shape as if Rutherford isn't on the ballot. And since we're going to have six possibly more candidates for sheriff, it's almost certainly going to be a race that goes to a second round. So the person who gets the most votes in the first round, like Mike Hogan for mayor 4 years ago, may not necessarily be in the best shape to win.